This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1019, A Conversation with Judd Winnick. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. This is episode 1019. I am your host, Adam Chapman, and this is another conversation with Judd Winnick. If you want to check out previous conversations with Judd, you can check out episode 554 from 2018, episode 666 and 668 from April of 2019. He was also on episode 764 from March 2020, episode 788 from June 2020, 854 from February 2021, and then last year he was on the January 31st episode, which was episode 946. So that is a lot of episodes. He's been so gracious with his time in the past. This is, I guess, what, the eighth episode that he's been on. It's always a pleasure to have him on. This time we talked less about kind of general comic book work, and we spent a lot more time on the Hi-Lo book series, which had its ninth book released this year. There's a tenth on the way in the early spring, so I'm very excited to have him hopefully back on the show then to talk about that chapter. But so we do talk about Hi-Lo book 9 in this particular episode. We do a deep dive, so we do get into some spoilers for that particular book if you haven't read it, but it was just a tremendous joy to be able to talk with Judd about this. This was Hi-Lo Book 9, Gina and the Last City on Earth. So it kind of brings to a close this part of this newest trilogy. The first six books comprise their own kind of big mega story, and then books 7, 8, and 9 are their own smaller trilogy. So I really enjoyed reading it, and it was great to talk to Judd about it. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, and also listen to us on Stitcher. And without further ado, let's jump right into the conversation with Judd Winnick. Enjoy. Judd, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I am excellent, sir. Thanks for having me back. And most importantly, as I'm sure you've heard from many, many folks who've come back on the program, it's good to have you back, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's good to be back. It's funny, when the book we're going to talk about today, Hi-Lo, Gina and the Last City on Earth, came out, I wasn't doing a podcast, and I had joked that I didn't have a chance to, I didn't have a mechanism to reach out to you. You were very kind. You're like, well, you can still let me know if you like it, and you can still talk to me. But then I did bring the show back, and now I finally got to talk to you about this volume. So again, and I always appreciate your time, and I'm such a huge fan of the Hi-Lo book series, and it's always nice to be able to chat with you about it.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. I really, really do.
So
I love doing it, and I'm glad you're still digging it.
Is it hard to believe that you've done, well, I mean, I know that you're probably prepping 10 to obviously come out in the spring, but is it hard to believe that you have 9 completed books on the shelves?
I'm working on number 11.
Oh, my God. So. You're way ahead.
And forgive me, it's not even doing a humble brag, it's just literally the way publishing works. Book 10 has been in the can for a while and being printed right now and coming out. February 27th, Hi-Lo Book 10, The Rise of the Cat. I'm also having to get my head around that we're going to talk about, right, we're talking about Book 9. So...
A long time ago in your head, I guess.
Quite some time ago, but again, everybody should have my problems. I'm routinely very, very excited that, we're coming up on, 2025 will actually mark 10 years since the first book was published. But right around now is we're coming up around a decade since I started. So for me, it's a little, it's hitting home that goodness, it's been 10 years of doing this. And I love it. And I'm very, very excited that it has continued. And I won't say I've taken it for granted, but I have to admit here and there I do take it for granted. My expectation is, we'll put it this way, every time a new book comes out, people usually say something along the lines of congratulations, like, oh, okay, all right, like, it's an accomplishment. No, it's just what I do. Okay, yeah, no, I got you. It's like, no, it wasn't. I'm extremely lucky, and it's not really a big debate with Random House. As long as I'm willing to keep making more books, they're willing to publish it. So, again, very, very lucky. Very lucky.
I mean, given obviously how much work it is to go into these books, do you look at, I mean, obviously at your contemporaries like Dav and be like, how does he create that much content?
Oh, God. I am constantly amazed at people who are able to do even more than what I'm doing. I'm able to handle about a book a year. And, you know, that is about it. I'm working really hard to possibly do more. The possibly do more stuff is that I have to get a couple of new best friends who will, you know, draw books while I write them. That's about as best I could possibly do. You know, it's the wonderful gig of being a cartoonist. You know, you get to write and draw stuff, and most of us are a little bit on the quicker side. It depends, you know. But graphic novels definitely take longer. I mean, I've got buddies who do prose and can do a lot more. It's like, yeah, well, sure, shoot. You know, if you're just writing the graphic novels, then sure. Or even in some cases, if you're just writing YA books, some folks can bang out, like, you know, like more than one a year. They manage to do that. Not me.
Would it be difficult at this stage in the game, after so many of these books, to go back to writing for someone else? Because, I mean, you are writing for yourself. You kind of have a good sense of what you can handle and what the beats are and how that's going to look like in your head. And obviously, you know, the beginning half of your career, a lot of it was, you know, you writing for someone else, but then you've transitioned into being, you know, as you said, being a fully fledged cartoonist and not needing someone else to kind of put your, you know, to translate your words into images. So what would it be like for you to kind of go back to being the writer?
It's going to be a bit of a challenge. It is. I you know, I clearly have a personal shorthand when I'm writing for myself. Mm-hmm. I don't have to spell things out quite as much as I do if I'm going to be writing a full script for somebody. And also, again, it's a plus minus. You know, a part of me feels like if I had my druthers, I would rather draw everything. I'd rather do the whole thing. But I am very enticed about the idea of collaborating, you know, again, with people, because in particular, a lot of cartoonists draw and render a hell of a lot better than I do. And that'll be fun. You know, I'm mostly thinking of it in the sense of, like, what I'm giving up, that I don't get to draw all these cool things that I'm thinking about, which I really love doing. That's the thing, is it isn't necessarily just about having control of the work. It's that, you know, as I'm writing it, like, I really would like to draw this, like, very cool monster or this action scene or what's going on here. Like, I'd like to do it. Mm-hmm. I enjoy drawing. So that part is, it's a little hard to give it up. But at the same time, I know I'll quickly stumble into seeing someone else do it. It'll be, I'll just have a giggle fit over, like, oh, this is so much fun. Look how cool that looks, like, because they're better than me. You know, I'll say that whoever I wind up working with will be absolutely a better cartoonist than me. I would not be able to handle someone who I thought, like, yeah, I could do better. I can't do that. Hmm. Whoever's drawing it, better than me. That's my only criteria.
It's interesting hearing you. You've always been very self-deprecating and very humble about your own abilities. And I do find it funny because, especially in this most recent book, in book 9, some of the emotional acting that you give Hilo and Izzy when they're having, I guess this is spoilers, but there's a conversation and it's so emotional. And the acting that you give to the characters and the way that you're able to portray the emotions is extremely heartfelt and I'm not going to say difficult to read, but because it is a great read, but it was just very emotional moments. And so, and that only works because of your skill.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate that. I mean, like, a lot. And I do not think I'm a slouch. You know, I'm often very impressed with my own work. I've got no problem with that. But I'm just guessing for collaboration. Mm. You want someone who can really, you know, beyond punch my weight. I want them again. I want someone who's better than me. I'm hoping that isn't too difficult. I'm assuming. I mean, I know what I'm able to do, and I know what I've seen. You know, every day I look at people who draw and render better than me. And at the same time, if I'm working with someone and I think that, you know, they've done something, a scene, a moment, and you know, so it doesn't quite deliver the goods, well, then we'll talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's what collaboration is about. You know, and as a writer, and I spent about 12 or 13 years writing superhero comics, mm-hmm. and working with artists who I'll argue to the cows come home were much better than I will ever be as far as, you know, just the ability to draw. They would all, every one of them could draw better than me, every one of them. And it was always a treat. Every single time, it was always like, you know, December holidays, opening presents, because you know, you come up with something, and they put it together, and they create the scene, and then you're looking at it like, wow, like I just wrote that stuff down on a page. These cats are actually bringing it to life, and that has always happened. Mm. And again, so a huge part of me looks forward to that.
I feel like this is a question that I've asked you before, but there's something about. Sure. The way that you draw Izzy is just something about the visual is just very appealing. And I think this is going to sound like a weird thing to say, but there's something really interesting about the way that you've designed her hair. I don't know why that always sticks out to me, but there's just something about the unique design and the way, I'm curious how you kind of settled on the visual for the hair of the character, because there's just something very playful about it. And I feel like it really works with that character in a way that I'm having difficulty kind of putting words to, but I'm hoping you can understand what I'm getting at here.
Oh no, I do. And I have to admit, as it is with a lot of design, that's a happy accident that I have an idea in my head, and when I carry it through and say, okay, I like that, and then as I get into it more, it's in the case of Izzy, to get really, really specific, you know, so she's got this weird thick hair. She's got locks, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, thick, like kind of bulbous tentacles. You know, I wanted her to, you know, I wanted her to look unique. I wanted her to look different. And I thought the hair might be the way to you know, get us in there. But as I was doing it, you know, quickly, it's like, yeah, you know what? And I'm always going to have like one of her locks just fall in front of her eyes, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, and without even, again, happy accident, without even realizing it until I'm realizing it, it's like, it's a little bit like she's peeking behind a curtain, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit like she's just kind of glancing at us a little bit, and it's a very evocative of the character. Like, I'm with you on that. And the more I did, the more I realized, like, oh, no, it's very her. It's very, you know, and I'll have a moment or two where, like, her hair is not in front of her eyes, you know, and then, and it does something. It does something to her face and her reaction and her acting, and it is. So I also appreciate that you're noticing. It's a huge compliment, sir. Thank you. I appreciate that.
There's a really interesting sequence that I enjoyed kind of rereading it afterwards in this book, and I think chapter 2, where you have the big reveal at the end of the chapter is that Hilo is talking to Izzy, which is definitely like kind of a gut punch reveal. And just, I always love the way that you name your chapters, right? And often it'll come up in an element of dialogue or whatever it might be. And so that was Hush was the name of this particular chapter. But then going back and reading that, all the sequences leading up to it, I realized, like, it was all there. Like, you could tell that something was not quite right. But you didn't know why. And then when you go back, mm-hmm. you can almost fill in what Izzy might be saying. And again, that's a testament to your skill as a cartoonist that, you know, you have this reveal and you go back and you're like, oh yeah, it's almost like you can start to fill in what that dialogue could have been, and it works because you kind of leave these pregnant pauses, or you leave these moments, or you have this dialogue, which is a little odd, but not so odd that it takes you out of the story. But when you go back, you're like, oh. And so I really appreciated that, that, you know, you have that kind of replayability of being able to see things that you didn't see before.
Oh, well, thank you. I feel the need to catch up anyone who possibly hasn't read it.
I guess I should have done that. I assume that people should listen to all the episodes we've done already on Hilo, but absolutely, please catch us up on where we are as I spoil the crap out of this.
No. And just for discussing this scene, it's as simple as that our titular character, Hilo, is he's in a dungeon. He's sitting in a dungeon, and his sister, Izzy, is there basically appearing. She's actually there, but appearing as a vision. No one can see her. Hilo's the only one who can see her. And he's talking to her, but no one else can see her, is the best way I can describe it. And again, thank you. I appreciate it. Because it was a thoughtful scene. It wasn't something that happened that we stumbled into. I had this idea in my head for a very long time, like that she's going to be here, but no one else can see her for quite a while. It's going to be sort of in Hilo's head, but she's there. Except that Hilo's not really sure that she is. His attitude is that, like, you're just in my head. Because no one else is here. So with that, going into it, it wasn't an afterthought. Like, okay, so what's going on in this scene? And she's there, and he's reacting to her. And, and how would that play out? And particularly, and it's played with a little bit of realism that what happens to people, there are people who, people who see things that aren't there. And what if the people who see things, this is a bit of a sidebar, but an interesting quote from Robert Downey Jr., who was discussing when he was basically tripping just out of his mind on drugs. And he had basically broken into someone's house and went and crawled into the bed of no one was there. The room was empty. Wandered into the house and crawled into the bed of this little girl. And this little girl, I came to her mom and said, "Mom, there's a man who's like sleeping in my bed." And she was like, "Oh, okay, really?" And comes in, and the woman sees, like, "Oh my God, there's a man here. Like, is that Robert Downey Jr.? And Robert Downey Jr. later described it like, "Yeah, no, I went to the house because, I thought I was, I was seeing snakes and I felt safer by being in someone's house. So I went there right away." Mm-hmm. And it's like, you thought there were snakes there? It's like, "No, I knew I was on drugs and I'm seeing snakes and I know they're not real. I thought the best thing I should do is go lie down." It's like, I'm not crazy. I thought it was really funny to describe, like, I'm having a hallucination, but I know it's not real. It's like it's not actually happening. In this case, I was thinking about that with Hilo. Like, what's going on for him is like, no, I know, like, I'm seeing Izzy and I'm talking to her, but she's in my head. She's not real. This isn't actually happening, but I do hear her, and he's just kind of going along with it. And now and again, she'll say things like, it's like, you don't think that. Like, yeah, well, you just know that because you're in my head. Mm-hmm. You know that I'm lying because that you're in my head and you know all my thoughts. Like, doesn't mean it's not actually happening. It's all that. So it was a very, very important back and forth. And I'm glad you dug it. I'm glad you dug it and actually saw it, could really appreciate it on a couple levels. So thank you, sir.
Speaking of those levels, I mean, it definitely felt like a real meditation as well on grief, what it is to, he knows that he needs to kind of listen to her, but he's also afraid that he'll lose her again if he does it. So he kind of wants to stay in this space because at least she's here, and dealing with what that would mean for someone who's lost someone like this. And now having her back, why would he do anything to jeopardize that? Is a very real meditation on grief. And this is obviously not something new where you have layered in very, deep and profound ideas. I've talked before about how the first six books are really a larger idea of an adoption story, kind of layered in there that, on the face of it looks like it's, a kid's book, but really there's some really heady themes in there. What was it like to kind of deal with and address these ideas of grief? Because these are not new things in your work. I mean, you've dealt with grief in a lot of different ways, both from personal and more abstract. So what was it like to kind of layer it into these, the way that these characters interacted here?
Oh, well, that's very profound, sir. And not something that I went into lightly or by accident. I mean, I think anybody who's lost someone would like nothing better than, everybody wants, ideally, it's just one more crack at beyond wanting them back in your lives and to be a part of your lives, experience part of your lives, the next tier down from that is, can I just talk to them one more time? Mm-hmm. Can I just want one more time to talk to them, because this was left unsaid. I want them to know how I am. It's important to me that I can sort of get through my life by just knowing that, you know, if I say this to them, that they can experience this and understand who I am and where we're at and what's going on. Just all this, you know, it's a huge common theme with loss. Just the one opportunity to just say goodbye, say your piece, say one more time, say one more thing. And I think it's as sophisticated as it might sound, a concept. Even kids who haven't experienced great loss, I think, can understand that and can appreciate it. And specifically from a story point of view, it's a promise I make to kids and what I tell them when it comes up. And those who follow along with the series, we're talking about Izzy, and at one point we lose Izzy. Izzy dies. And you can imagine a lot of very young readers were not happy with this. Hmm. We're very upset by it. And literally I have, you know, upset children talking to me about it. You know, why did you kill Izzy off? And I explained to them. I said, okay, the easiest answer, the simple answer we'll just start with is that I thought it made it for a really good story. I know it's sad, but I think it makes it takes us to a place which makes the story better overall. But I also tell them that it's not something I'm doing lightly, that we're not gonna never talk about Izzy again. Mm-hmm. And as we did here with, you know, in the ninth book, is that, you know, her loss is still felt, still there. I will tell you, for the next couple of books, we're not dealing with the loss of Izzy head on. But it's always going to be there. And going forward, her loss is going to be discussed even further, because we never, you know, it's something I talk about often when we talk about loss and grief, is that, you know, grief is a weight that you learn to carry. Mm-hmm. It isn't something that, that goes away. You don't get over it. You just learn and get stronger and are able to walk around with it every day. And it's not somebody who's just pulling you down. So that'll be the experience with Hilo and Gina and DJ when talking about Izzy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not done with her, because we're never done. You know, one is never done with loss.
What is always, and I know we've talked about this for sure, so entertaining about your books is that you were able to, again, delicately have these types of themes in them, but also you have moments where Polly turns into a giant version of herself and just goes to town. So you have a lot of really fun stuff where you have this anthropomorphic cat is suddenly even bigger, and, you know, just this very larger-than-life character is exercising basically a power fantasy, and it's a lot of fun. But at the same time, you have these serious moments, and it's nice to have you kind of balance between them. It does feel often where the books will be a little bit more front-loaded with humor as we kind of delve into the story, and then we have more of an emotional crux at the end, which is, I would imagine, by design. But what was it like, or for you, just to be able to be like, I'm going to make Polly giant?
Well, that was really exactly that. Like, what would be fun here? I kind of want Polly to kick all kinds of butt. And what would be just an interesting play? And like, and what haven't I done before? Hmm. You know, this is magic. We can do anything. And when the idea just occurred to me, like, oh, what if she just becomes a giant? Oh, no, yeah, well, okay. We'll bring a huge creature there, and then she'll become giant. And then she'll just, you know, do like full-on fisticuffs. No magic. A full-on, like, fight them up. And for me, experience that way. One of my favorite personal tropes that I do often is, you know, when something extraordinary is happening, when something over the top ridiculous is happening, terrifying is happening, I'm way more interested in characters being excited by that terror, excited by something crazy going on, than actually being cowed or nervous by it. Hmm. Like, bring it on. Like, this is, how much fun is this? I'm clearly doing that in that scene. As well as, yes, good call. I do front load as much of the silliness as up front as we can. It's a little bit like, you know, we're gonna have our our ice cream before we get to our broccoli, you know. And that's a, I mean, I think most good stories, you know, if you have a comedic bent, and we, you know, and I play Hilo for a lot of laughs. It's supposed to be fun, but at the same time, you know, my favorite dramas are really funny too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what makes The West Wing great is that it has lots and lots of jokes. It is a drama, but lots of humor. You know, and the humor is just that much more better because of the jokes you put in. And so when we keep it funny, we keep it extremely light. When it gets downright goofy, I think it plays to the further strengths of, you know, when we're getting a little more serious, or a lot more serious.
There's it's not a long moment, but you do have a moment where you have Reggie, who's Gina's grandmother, or great-great-great-great-grandmother. I can't remember exactly how many greats, but you do have her.
Honestly, I can't remember either, and it's okay. I will pretend to know, but when it comes up, I often just have to look it up. Like, how many greats are there? I think it's three. I couldn't swear to it, but
I very much enjoyed her turning into a tree, mainly because, again, it felt like you were really kind of cutting loose on, you know, what you can do as a cartoonist. And it was incredibly fun in terms of, I keep saying acting, and I hope, again, that makes sense, but the way that you kind of portray the character and the facial expressions, very deadpan. You feel like you can hear the dialogue in those types of moments because it's so descriptive. Sorry, not descriptive, but it's so on their face. It's so, you know, it's a tree, yet somehow you make the emotion come off very well, and it was a very fun, I almost wish it went on longer because it was just so much fun to see this character that we've seen be a lot more vibrant and active suddenly reduced to being a tree. It was very fun.
For one, yes, I always refer to it as acting as well. So that's, I mean, that's even when I talk about other artists and how great they are and the work they do, I often talk about first and foremost, not the action scenes they put together. I'll often say the acting. Because, you know, a lot of cats can, like, draw an explosion or a fight scene or whatnot. But getting close and doing some really good acting, that's the best. So I always call it acting. And as far as in those play at home, there's a scene where Gina's grandmother, who is also a sorceress, gets turned into a tree for about, I don't know, six pages, maybe less. I'm with you. Like, always want, they always leave them wanting more. Mm-hmm. Less is more. And for me, I honestly, God, it still cracks me up. I crack myself up there. I love the tree bit. I love the tree bit, and also I love playing against sort of type. She gets turned into a tree, and is she scared? Is she outraged? No, she's just ticked. Just deeply irritated. Oh man, I'm a tree, you know. Which just tells you that, you know, she can't do anything, she can't fight, she's just stuck here as a tree, and she rolls down a hill. It's just so deeply irritating. And then we got to turn her back, which is like a little bit of a thing. It just cracks me up. And yeah, I'm also with you. It could go on longer. It's a good joke. We're having some fun there. But you know, again, you got no one to cut out. Leave early. Leave the party early.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of something that felt like you were having just a blast was you have a brief sequence where you're in, I guess, for lack of a better word, in Hilo's kind of mindscape. And it's very fun because you have, like, basically his head and you have the mangoes everywhere and, like, the sun's a mango. And, like, it's very, again, very fun. And then almost immediately when you have this exploration inside his brain, you also then have, you know, the moment where you have, you know, DJ and Gina being able to kind of hug Izzy and being able to see her again. So you have the ridiculous and then you have the sublime right after it. What was it like kind of creating that inner mindscape? You don't spend a lot of time really fleshing it out, but it when it's there, it hits hard because it's, you feel like you know this character. Of course, that's what it looks like inside.
Yeah, I think it wasn't fleshed out because it's a lot of work to draw it.
I can imagine.
We're gonna get in and out here pretty quickly. And for those playing at home, we are literally talking about going inside Hilo's head, and so it's full of Hilo's Hiloisms. Like, it's loaded with, you know, mostly mangoes, which just I knew, you know, that for me is like, it's kind of a gimme, kind of a cheap joke. Hilo loves mangoes, so of course we're gonna have like a mango motif everywhere. Again, like, we're doing something kind of serious, but there's no reason why we can't have a whole bunch of fun while we're getting there. And again, it is one of these moments where, like, you know, it's like, yeah, I can't stay too long here because there's a lot of business going on here. It's a lot to draw, you know. And I also sheepishly know, like, yeah, my colorist has got to color all this, and she's going to be the one, Marta Liejo, my colorist Marta Liejo is going to be the one who like really brings this thing to life. You know, it's like, this has got to glow, it's got to come back and forward, you got to really make it work, and she always does. So it is always fun. It's cooking up, you know, drawing a good monster, cooking up a weird scene, you know, before I was speaking to you, I'm just about to get to a page where basically a dinosaur is fighting a spaceship, and I can't wait. It's going to be fun, you know. I've poorly designed the dinosaur, meaning that I'm cheating on the places where it's hard to draw a dinosaur. Like, yeah, I'm just going to mess with the legs so I can draw them easier, because it's not a real dinosaur. It's like it's like a space dinosaur, so I can do whatever I want. And it's going to be so much fun. It's, you know, I'm going to have like a full couple of hours of drawing a dinosaur fighting a spaceship, and that's going to be great. It's going to be a good time.
That's awesome. One thing I appreciated about this book, because at times DJ has a tough role, right? Because he is the straight man who has all this kind of fantastical stuff happen around. And what I really appreciated about this particular volume was that it definitely felt like he was a little bit more kind of taking the bull by the horns. Because he's like, no, we got to go save our friend. We're going to go make this happen. Didn't really matter how dangerous that was going to be. He was very much like, no, we're making this happen. And I thought that he took charge more. And I thought that was a really nice kind of turn for the character. Because, again, he is sometimes sidelined a little bit, only because he's not the most exciting one. He's not the one doing the magic. He's not the one flying around, you know, firing bolts from his hands. He is the every guy. So it's nice to kind of see him taking more of a leadership role, or more of a role in his own destiny, and protecting his friends, and seeing him kind of become that person.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for noticing, because again, that was by design, because last couple of books, last couple of adventures, DJ's taken a little bit of a, back seat here and there. And it is not without complaint from readers. Again, I'm very lucky to do this, but anybody who makes stuff up or creates things, so one of the things you do is somebody's favorite. So there's a lot of young people and readers who DJ is their favorite, probably because they see themselves in DJ a lot. And when DJ is playing a smaller role, they were not kind of digging on that. So I want to make, you know, so I'm actually working towards, and as you'll see in, not in book 10, but in book 11 and going forward a little bit, is we're going to be seeing and feeling a lot more from DJ. Cause I like him too. Cause DJ in very many ways is us, you know, he's more me than any other character. Mm-hmm. But he'll always be, you know, he's just a regular human. He's not going to get powers. That's not his role. Because I think there's something to DJ that he is heroic without having superpowers. He'll be able to do stuff. He'll be kicking a little more butt. I'm working on the DJ kicking a little more butt. But he's never going to be able to do magic or shoot lasers out of his hands like some of his buddies.
Now, this volume obviously has a kind of a big, you know, a climactic moment with a decision that Gina has to make, which you end up kind of doing a slight redesign on the character as time passes. What was that like, kind of developing what that would look like in a natural, organic way?
Yeah. I was going to have a little bit of fun with that, just as far as, again, for those playing at home, by the close of our book, Gina is now more of a full-fledged sorceress and has got a bunch of work to do. And with that, she can't just dress like a regular 10-year-old girl. She's got to get on her butt-kicking togs. So thankfully, I had a little bit of forethought in that I'm going to design an outfit for her. And keeping in mind that I might have to draw this more than once, I don't want to go down the road of, we've probably even talked about this before because I bring it up often. For those who read a lot of comics, so Walt Simonson's run on Thor, he often talks about his design on the character Beta Ray Thor. Beta Ray Thor is an alien who manages to snatch up Thor's hammer and and gain the abilities of Thor. And he turns into his own version of Thor with like this just hot spit helmet and leggings and armor. And it's just, it's a gorgeous costume. Walt Simonson did an incredible job designing it. And Walt Simonson years later talked about it, that I loved it. It was a great design. It was a beautiful costume. Had a lot of fun doing it. And then by the second issue that he's in, I am ready to kill myself. I can't believe I got to draw this thing over and over again. It just, he said it hadn't occurred to me. He said we were too far down the road. Like it was being, it's like, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's being colored. It's going to be published. And I got to do this. He said, so I had to go do some very careful work about how to sort of pare it down that I could keep doing it because it was very, very complicated. So in this way, I had a lot of fun in like, yeah, let me give Gina some kick-ass togs. Let me give her some like sorceress outfit that she looks like she's out there and doing some fun stuff. And at the same time, keep in mind, this might come back. And case in point, here I am doing book 11 and Gina's still wearing that outfit. And, you know, and thankfully I'm drawing it. With the exception of I gave her fingerless gloves. And I decided, you know what? I am not going to do that. And just for the reason, like I'm gonna be drawing it. I'm gonna forget the fingerless gloves like a lot, a lot. I know it. And then it's just to be going back and giving my colorist Marta, like Marta, can you fill in the fingers? Great. Can you fill them in again? Because I forgot again on this page. This page too. She's supposed to have the fingerless gloves. You can just feel it.
Now with. In this particular volume, we get to see a little bit more of Tamir. I don't know if we talked about that kind of design before, but what kind of went into designing that character?
Oh, well, he was just... Well, for those playing at home, we have a mysterious character named Tamir, who's a big anthropomorphic cat, to say the least, closer to a mountain lion, really. I would say more mountain lion-ish. And that was kind of in my head when I was doing him. His backstory, for those playing at home, is that he was on Polly's planet, oh, maybe a good 1,000 years ago, and he was the most adept, aggressive, even vicious warrior who pretty much took over the planet by force, going from village to village, city to city, and amassing an army and taking over the entire planet. And after he took over the entire planet, he buried his sword, chucked it all, and became a teacher. Became a leader who led by peace and, you know, sort of a Gandhi-like figure. And so for me, I like the idea because he's huge and buff and just gigantic. You know, he's bodybuilder size. He's Conan size. He's a big, big character. But I like the idea like this big hunk of beef is someone who is now a quiet teacher, someone who leads through discussion and learning and kindness. There's something fun about that. Something fun about someone who is as physically as imposing as that. But, you know, his teachings are more along, again, more like Gandhi is tiny and frail. Right? Very small, but powerful in what he's able to do and his words. So this puts it on its head that, like, well, this is someone who's also powerful in his body as well as powerful in spirit. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what went into it. I wanted just someone who looked incredibly badass, but that is no longer why he is badass.
In the first six, I want to say issues, but then the first six volumes of the Hilo series, you had a little bit more of like, obviously, more of a sci-fi bent because you're dealing with a super-powered robot, for lack of a, obviously there's more nuance to it than that, but that's essentially what you have. And you obviously have magic there as well. And then these last few books are obviously much more magic-centric. What can you tease about what direction we go moving forward? Because we've really delved in the magic. Is it more magic, or do it bring back a little bit more of that kind of sci-fi bent? Or what can you even say without spoiling too much?
I can say yes to all that. In book 10, which is called Rise of the Cat, which comes out, again, February 27th, which is all takes place entirely on Polly's world, which is entirely about Polly and her little brother Pip, and is all magic. Like, she lives in a magical world, So it is all magic and mayhem that comes from that, and that'll be fun. And then following up right after that with book 11, I won't get into it too much just yet, but then we go full sci-fi again. We go back, full science fiction again. For me, it's just, you know, I want to keep it interesting for the readers and also a little bit interesting for me. I don't, you know, it's, I like fantasy and I like magic, you know, as much as I like science fiction, and they're kind of different. I mean, it's funny. I'm having these conversations with my editor who, Shayna is who's not a massive sci-fi and fantasy fan. She's not only an editor, but she's a writer of children's book herself. But again, not a huge sci-fi fan. And she keeps wanting me to sort of break down the differences. Like, well, what is the difference between, like, here? What's the difference between magic and like, science? And I was like, well, I said, I keep coming back to one world's science is another world's magic. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about the idea conceptually, which I think is coming from Isaac Asimov, the idea that if you take a human being from, let's say, just the year 2023 and send them back to, you know, the 1920s with some tech, people might be freaked out, but no one's going to think it's witchcraft. Mm. Right. Whereas if they go back to the 1600s or even the 1700s, they might get burned at the stake, you know. Because it seems completely unnatural. It seems like witchcraft, opposed to science. They are not, you know, they as a culture are not kind of caught up remotely. They're not in our league remotely for technology. But anyway, I love sci-fi, I love fantasy, and I like doing a little bit of both. And if when I'm switching it up, it is purely at one, my whim, that I'm getting a little tired of doing this. I want to do a little more of that. Mm-hmm. Also coupled with, I think it'll be fun for the readers, you know, if we mix it up a bit.
Absolutely. Now, a question, I know we've talked before about how when you first kind of envisioned the Hi-Lo series, you had like, I think it was, wasn't it like a 20 book span or something, you know, very big, right? And that your editors and were like, no, think smaller. And, you know, if you're doing one book a year, you don't want to, you know, have a big, too big a story, because by the time you get there, they might not be reading it anymore, right? So and then you started to pare things down. I think that you'd said before that obviously the Genus story was, you know, three volumes, so you kind of did it as a trilogy, so to speak. Moving forward from that into book 10 and now 11, how do you start plotting that out? Is it more kind of doing arcs, kind of mini arcs like that again, or are you more interested in more staccato rhythms where you have kind of standalone, so to speak, or like how did you approach once you were done this trilogy?
Well, initially, the I want to do it in 20 books, and I wound up doing it in 6. Came about, yes, because my editor had mentioned to me that, like, you know, if a kid is, you know, 10 years old when they first start reading Hi-Lo, by the time they get to the end of the series that you're planning, they're going to be 30. And it's like, oh, right, okay, so yeah, maybe we should make it a little more concise. And for me, that was, as a storyteller and just intellectually, that was going to be what became the first big story arc with Hi-Lo. You know, who he is, where he comes from, this big battle with Razor Wark. I was going to take 20 books to just wrap that up. But once I did it in 6, like, okay, so what else we got? And with each story arc, I've got a little bit, you know, I'm trying to figure out exactly how long that might be. I will say with this one with Polly, which is a bit of a Polly arc, I don't have an exact number-ish. It's I was thinking between 4 and 5, depending on how things kind of came together. But what immediately happened, giving away a little bit. As I said, we're going to Polly's world, and we're spending time with her and her little brother Pip, and we don't see too much of Hi-Lo and Gina and DJ in this volume. But I started thinking about what they would be doing while Polly was having this adventure, And what initially was that I was going to do just like kind of a 5-page like flashback in the next book. Like, this is what we were up to while we were doing this. And like, oh, holy cow. And then as I started thinking about it, the story got a little bit bigger. And for a hot minute, it's like, can I devote like 20 pages to what they were doing back on Earth while Polly and Pip were doing their thing on their planet? And that's when I thought about, like, you know what? I think this is a whole book. I can do this as a whole book. Like completely, like, aside it, like, this is the adventure that they were having while Polly was... And I just checked with my editor, like, is it okay if I, like, break from the Polly thing and do an entire book with the three of them, like, what they were up to while... And she goes, yeah, that'd be fun. It's like, okay, cool. If you think it's cool, I'm cool. Let's do it. And that's, you know, again, so this book became a funny sidebar as to, so Polly's doing this while Hilo and DJ and Gina are doing that. And it kind of overlaps, which will be fun, which will be a lot of fun.
Now, obviously Polly is a character who really took on a life of her own, and now you have Pip as well. Obviously, you've always enjoyed those characters, and you can tell just in terms of the visuals, you're really giving them a lot of great, fun moments, and maybe some of your personal favorite moments. What was it like kind of further developing Pip? Because again, you know, Polly was this amazing, you know, breakout character, and then you bring in Pip, who's very similar but also different. And so what was like kind of developing a counterpoint to Polly in terms of her own brother?
Well, Pip came about because I didn't want Polly to become too one note. I didn't want her just to be, you know, over and over again, same sort of gig for her. And how can I trip things up for Polly without losing the Polly-ish of her? And what would I thought be helpful if there was someone even more outrageous than her? Which, and that's when sort of like, now what if she's got a little apprentice? Like, oh, wait, what if the apprentice is her little brother? And like the dynamic just came together. Like, and what if he's like, you know, even like less in control than Polly is, you know, has less sense of, you know, self-control than she does. This will be fun. And that wound up being fun. And it also allows Polly now and again to still be Polly. I never kind of want to lose how ridiculous she is and how much fun she is. But here and there, she's got to be the big sister, and she has to be the adult one in the room here and there when it comes to Pip. But I'll say again, I never like it when, when a side character becomes a lead. You see it on TV shows where they spin characters off, that sometimes the qualities that make them amazing kind of go away because suddenly they have to be in charge. I'm not going to name those specific things. I'll name when it works. Let's say on television, when Frasier spun off, they made that work because, for one, they found someone even fussier than Frasier. They gave him a brother who's even fussier than Frasier. And they are similar in their fussiness. It's actually a pretty good comparison with Pip and Polly. Pip and Polly are both, like, just absolutely no self-control. That works. One is even less self-controlled than the other, and that makes it kind of fun. So those are when it works. But sometimes, again, the magic goes away because suddenly they're in charge more, and they got to carry the weight.
Now, a question I had at the beginning of this particular volume, you have a great flashback moment with, Reggie kind of seeing her past when she first started seeing magical creatures. And you do a lot of different magical creatures in a very quick span of pages. I'm curious, yeah. I mean, one, what was it like kind of developing various different models of magical creatures? And then do you keep like an ongoing reference book, so to speak, so that if you want to kind of go back to a certain style or see more of that particular type of magical creature or monster, that you can then kind of bring that out? Or like, how do you kind of keep a record of all those things? Because again, there's only a few pages here, but you have so many different types of, you know, creatures show up so quickly, and some of them are extremely fun to look at. But again, how do you kind of keep it all straight for yourself?
Okay, full admission. Okay, so when they're drive-bys, when they're quick ones like that you're describing, that they're just going to be in there for a panel, they're just going to be in there for like a good couple of moments, not even a full page, they usually get designed right there. And it was sort of like, what's the joke I'm going for here? What kind of monster or creature would work really well in this moment? And then it also allows me to kind of go to town a little bit. Like, I can make this, I can go full Beta Ray Thor, as we discussed. I can get it as complicated as I like, because we are never going to see this character again. Now, an excellent example is that in this most recent volume I'm doing, we have, we'll call entire squads of creatures, just tons of them. And in that case, it's like, all right, got to take a minute, got to sit down, and I got to design them. Okay, so what am I doing in this scene? What is going on here? And what do we need them to do? And what do they like? And what is their personality? And, you know, it's like, are these guys, you know, are they like little, like, I think they'd be funny if they're dinosaurs, if they look like kind of raptors with like clothing, you know, like that they walk around on, you know, they've got body armor and they walk around on two legs, you know, like a big giant, like kind of largest, maybe like skinny little T-Rex arms. Like, that'd be funny because that makes them both look kind of imposing and kind of stupid at the same time. Let's do that. And, you know, and again, in those cases, like, got to think it through. What would be funny? What sort of makes sense? And I also like playing against type a little bit. Like, the bigger, the meaner looking a character, then that's the one I want who's, like, really trying to get good pizza. You know, like, the thing that's, like, you know, that just plays against, like, look at this big monster. He's like, yeah. Do you guys know where we get really good pizza around here? Like, that's more funny for me than some raw monster. Mm-hmm. So again, to recap, if they're a quick hit and run, I will just go to town and make them up literally practically sometimes just on the page as I'm drawing them. But if they're going to be more than a page or two, or they're going to be recurring, that's the time to roll up the sleeves, grab the sketchbook, and we're gonna go to a little work and experiment on, figure it out.
No, one of these kind of drive-by moments you have, I'm gonna say what the character says, just as a way of jogging your memory. You have a big purple monster who says, "I am the mighty Kravarum, devourer of worlds." And so when I read that, I obviously think of Galactus. And I was like, was that a specific colorist note to be like, make sure it's purple?
No, I didn't realize that Marta made him purple. Maybe she, God. What part of the book is that?
And that's, I literally have to go page 16 of volume 9.
Okay, we're gonna test the limits of my headphones as I walk and go into the outer office to grab book 9, because I don't have one sitting next to me. Let's see, book 9. Give me the page again.
Page 16.
Is this on top of my head? I'm already remembering. Is this the guy who goes down the toilet bowl?
Yes.
Yeah, there he goes. No, okay. This also one of my favorite gags is someone incredibly powerful showing up and making some huge proclamation and then being dispensed with really easily. I do that. This would probably not the first time or last time I'll be doing that. And no, I don't think they are purple.
Oh, no? Because, I am slightly colorblind.
No, they are purple. I was saying, like, not purple because of Galactus. I don't know if I even gave Marta a note on that. My notes in a lot of cases are, especially when it comes to these creatures, like, so yeah, I don't have a really good color sense. You know, or rather, it could be a heck of a lot better considering I'm a professional artist. but I do tell her often, it's like, all right, now based on the background, based on the landscape, just something that'll pop a little bit. You know, because they're going to be there, but we're going to be here briefly. And she'll decide. And in this case, purple. Purple worked really, really well. So, no, he's not Galactus.
I just wonder if it was a deliberate color choice, but that's interesting. I'm actually, since you actually have the book in front of you.
No, and I'm not even 100% sure. Yeah,
if you go to...
I'm not even 100% sure that I remember Devourer of Worlds. When I wrote that, if I even remembered that I'm ripping off Galactus. I don't even know if I even remembered I was ripping off Galactus.
That's funny.
Man, I do know that now. I totally. Who else is the devourer of worlds?
Right.
Who else has that phrase? No, it's totally Galactus.
If you go to page 26, it's a visual design. I love that there's. It's almost like two distinct versions of the same character because you have this character running, mouth open, crazy teeth, and it's just such a great visual. And then you have with the mouth closed, it almost looks like a different character, but two different sides of this character, and it was just such a funny gag.
Thank you. And then yes, purely again by designing and knowing what you know. I don't have many skills, but I do know when things look funny, and in this case, I know when. You know, nothing cracks me up more than people like yelling. And as you can see, like big giant open mouth yells are something that happens quite often in Hilo.
Mm-hmm.
When that yelling face goes away, and if it's a face of complete calm, like, yep, it's funny. It's funny to me. That's why most of these jokes happen, because I think they're funny.
Now, in terms of, we talked again before about the idea of that, you know, you have this sense of grief here. Another big theme of this book is really finding oneself and who you're supposed to be or what you're meant to be. And if that's okay, if that's something you want. So with Gina, she kind of realizes what she needs to do and then kind of takes that on. What was it like kind of developing that for the character and that sense of belonging? Because, I mean, she's found herself being able to tap into this magical world, finds out it's actually something that's in her family lineage, so she doesn't feel so alone. So outside of normal, it actually feels like she's found herself, and now she's able to take this leap and do this big thing that is something that, again, her family member had kind of done as well. What was it like to explore that with this character?
This was her arc. This is what it was all about. I can wax and wane on it a lot, except that I think I'd fall back on, like, this is the story. This is where it was always going to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, for her was a little bit of, well, not a little bit, like, this was her arc. It was, she's going to find who she is and what she needs to do and how she needs to do it. So often with heroes and you know characters that have powers and do things like this, they don't get to have that full fledged cathartic sense of self discovery. And mostly because a lot of hero books are just ongoing stories, particularly superhero stories. In this case, she gets to land somewhere, and I liked that. I like where she wound up, and what happens next is it's not something that's discarded. Again, it's like it's going to be part of an ongoing story about who she is and what she's able to do and how she's able to do it. But that was always the goal. You know, particularly we're getting to the third book here, and a lot of this has been about her. And now she has to rise to the occasion. She has to be who she really, really needs to be. As well as, you know, many of the other characters throughout the book, that's what they're finding too, who you really are.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, we talked about how, you know, DJ was kind of the initial kind of point of view character, and he's kind of, you know, it's bled away from him because other characters have kind of taken center stage. It'll be interesting to see, you know, he has dealt with so much of this, but we haven't necessarily seen it all from his perspective. Like, we've seen Hilo lose his sister, so obviously it's going to be a most immediate way of examining grief through his eyes. Gina herself, of you know, sense of self-discovery, it's coming through her eyes. It'd be interesting to at some point see what DJ kind of makes of everything around him changing so much. But he himself is, you know, he doesn't have superpowers, as you said. He's not, you know, magic. He's started to become more of a forthright person. But going through all this, these different elements of loss must be taxing on the character as well.
Yeah. And we are literally getting to that. I don't want to say any more than that, because it is something literally that is being explored. That exact theme about what DJ's experience is in all this. And he's for most occasions, he's usually pretty tight-lipped about a lot of the goings-on and what his feelings are with a lot of the goings-ons. But I will say, with some of the goings-ons, he's reaching a point where he has something to say. Mm-hmm. he has an opinion about how their lives are transpiring. Mm-hmm. And that's coming up. And it's part of the larger story as well, which will be fun.
I mean, and again, that makes sense because even here in this book, we started seeing him become more like, no, I want to save someone. I'm going to do it. And again, not waiting for someone else to do it who may have powers, you know, like the fact that he's able to kind of fight for what's right and what he wants. And if that means saving someone, let's go save someone. It doesn't matter that he has to, you know, get on a magical creature that's going to teleport somewhere and break someone out of a prison. He's going to make it happen, which, you know, book one DJ would not have done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it is something that I'm absolutely playing with, and also knowing that how to put this without giving away too much, or just, well, in this is that I am not planning on doing this. I mean, I can't go. The story can't go on for 50 years. It's not going to outlive me or anything, you know. And we're gonna reach some sort of ending at some point. I don't know when that is. I don't know how that is. I do have a very good sense of how I wanted it to end. I was satisfied with it ending with the six books. You know, if it was never going to go beyond that, if Random House had no interest in taking this further and wanted me to cook up something else completely, I would have done that as well. But at some point, we're going to draw to a close. And with that, you are given the luxury of having your characters grow and change. Mm. You know, opposed to, you know, they're like Spider-Man and Superman and whatnot, that they're kind of stuck in amber, that they can only grow and change just so much. And if they do and you want to take it back, then you got to take it back in some weird metaphysical way or reboot your line or whatever the hell you're going to do. And in this case, you know, we're not doing that. You know, we're going to have these characters do something and end somewhere and go someplace. So it is something that I have to keep in mind and I am planning on.
I almost felt like I was naively surprised that Hilo actually had powers again, because not that he couldn't, but it just felt like maybe that part of the story had been over. So it was actually very refreshing to be like, oh, he's got them again, because I did not necessarily expect that to happen, because we were moving in different directions. And that's a testament to yourself as a creator and as a storyteller that, you know, I was not bothered either way. I was just kind of, oh, he's got powers again. That's awesome. But also, if he had just been human from now on without powers, obviously he's still human with powers, but if he was human without any powers, that would have been fine too. That was just the story that we were telling. So it was interesting that you're able to, I almost feel naive to say that I was surprised, but I was.
Nah, it's because you're a grown-up, that's why. I wouldn't say number one, but top five questions after Hilo. So those playing at home, and spoiler, at one point Hilo loses his powers. He's just a human being and can't do anything anymore. And in this one, again, spoiler, he's still a human being, but now he's got powers. One of the top five questions after Hilo didn't have powers anymore was, when is Hilo going to get his powers back with kids? And I knew, I mean, I didn't want to tell them, like, it's like, oh no, he was always going to get his powers back, don't worry. And mostly because, like, I'm a big kid too, and it's like guys, I'm with you. You know, he's got to get his powers back. This is a superhero book, man. He's got to fly around and shoot lasers out of his hands. He's got to do that. Like, I'm with you, right here. It's going to happen. So for me, it was never a question. It was just sort of like, you know, when and how and organically. And I always felt at the end of this arc with Gina, like, yeah, this is a good spot. And well, you know, I had an idea how it was going to happen with Izzy and how it was all going to come together and what it meant. And again, got really kind of super metaphysical and, you know, and a little bit mumbly, jumbly, complicated. And I'm glad, I mean, in talking to the kids who've read it, I always grill them about, like, did you understand what was going on? Because that was my number one question to my editor, like, is this clear? Are they going to get it? Is this too convoluted? Is this too much, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, mumbo-jumbo going on? Are they going to get it? And my editor really has a very good sense of what kids can gronk and say, like, no, they'll get it. It's fine. Like, it's not too complicated. Like, okay. Should I always tell you when it's like, I don't know what's going on. Like, okay. So, so in that, yeah, he was always going to get his powers back. I'm glad I fooled you, but again, I'm saying, yeah, it's easy to fool you. You're a grown up. You know, every kid is like, oh no, of course he's gonna get his power back. They'll all the kids knew. All the kids knew.
That's funny. Well, apparently I'm not nearly as smart and plugged in as a child.
No, you're just a grown up. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, I have no expectation for you to be getting this.
I guess there's more. I was just like, well, that was the story. That was the story that was told. And again, the fact that you had, Gina becoming the focal point, I was just like, oh, we're just moving on, you know, and these characters are still around, but, you know, they're not the focal point. So I guess that's why I had the, I was ready to believe the narrative as sold without really thinking it through, I guess.
Don't get me wrong. I am pleased that I fooled you. I'm glad.
All right. Well, Judd, thank you so much for taking the time to go so deep into this volume. Again, I was so sad that I didn't have the podcast artifice to kind of make it happen when the book came out. Would love to have you come back, obviously, when book 10 does finally come out. I say finally. It's on a schedule, on a very strict schedule, so it's not a case of it being late or anything. But I'm excited to read it when it does come out, and would love to have you back if you're game.
I am absolutely game, sir. I would love to talk about it. And again, I appreciate you being back. And also, I appreciate your incredibly thoughtful questions. This is, you know, I will take a knock to, like, you know, on other podcasters, which sometimes we don't really get in there. You know, it's really just sort of like it's a lot of surface. Mm. And I'm okay answering the surface questions, but this is a lot more fun for me. And I know it's probably a lot more fun for other creators as well. You choose to get in there. We appreciate it.
I think it's interesting, right? Because I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, you have name cachet and people want to talk about your superhero stuff too, but you're also doing some really amazing work right now. And I think that unfortunately they want to get to the comic book stuff. But they're like, but this stuff's really good and should not be overlooked by any means, because it might look like, oh, it's for kids, but it's not. It's for anyone. And it's, you know, I can read it with my kid, which is great. And that was one of the things you said was kind of the impetus between you even doing a book like this was, you know, a lot of the stuff that you've written in comics was so dark and adult and, you know, very good, but also not necessarily something you give to a five-year-old. But then Hilo is exactly, you know, perfect for a family to read together. And it's been so much fun to read with my son throughout the years.
Well, thank you, sir. And I hope more fun to come for you and your kiddo.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Well, and now I have a little girl who we adopted in the pandemic. And so I'm excited. She's about 4 and a half. So she's about at the right stage where I can start kind of reading through Hilo with her. I think she's going to love the fun stuff. The other stuff obviously will go a little bit over her head. But again, as I said before, I really, going through an adoptive process with a child made me so much more sensitive in noticing those elements in your work. And so I'm excited to kind of go through that with her and see if she picks up on any of that kind of stuff, because, you know, she is an adopted child. We don't talk about it all the time, but she knows it exists and knows it's a thing. And obviously, and my son knows because he was 6 years old when we got her. So I'm very interested to just kind of see how she feels about this world. And I think she's going to love, again, all the humor and all the fun stuff that you pepper into these books, because they're just a lot of fun.
Oh, well, thank you, sir. I'm very eager to hear what she thinks.
Absolutely. Anyways, well, again, thank you so much for taking so much of your time. Get back to work on volume 11, because I can't wait to see that in 2025.
Ah, you bet. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks so much.